Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to a December 12 segment from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. Today we have a very special guest, and that would be Nora McCobie. Am I pronouncing that correct, Ms. McCobie?
McCobie, actually.
McCobie, okay, very good. Thank you. Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, originally I was going to have your husband and then yourself as a dual guest.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, he had a meeting this morning, wasn't able to join us. So perhaps you could help our audience to understand this unique couple that is definitely at the forefront of promoting alternative energy technology here in America and, of course, for the benefit of the whole world. How about your background first? I understand that you're vice president of a company that was started by your father,
mm-hmm.
and that would be McCobie.
The McCobie Group.
McCobie, I'm sorry, yeah, McCobie Group, okay.
Well, basically, I was born in Mexico. My father was studying with a man named Eric Fromm, a psychoanalyst, and researching the notion of social character. They wrote a book together called Social Character in a Mexican Village. And we also worked very closely with an orphanage that started in Mexico, but it's now in 9 different Latin American countries. And it's a really incredible model of creating leaders and sustainable communities in every way. So that was kind of my background as a child. We then moved to Washington, D.C., where I went to a Quaker school. And was kind of schooled in the idea that, you know, it was up to us to be the tipping point in the fate of the planet's destiny. So I, at an early age, decided that I needed to infiltrate the media. That was my mission. And so I trained in documentary filmmaking with Charles Guggenheim and his son, Davis, just made An Inconvenient Truth. And then I started making little documentaries, political documentaries, in high school. And I started a network television thing in my school, Sidwell Friends. And I was... what happened. Oh, yeah, and then I was also a violinist, and my teacher was a woman named Sheila Johnson. I started with her at age 5 and until 17, and she basically, while she was supporting her family teaching violin, she and her husband were creating Black Entertainment Television. So she went on to become the first female Black billionaire, and I basically was able to learn at her feet, you know, how to do the impossible. So she was very much my teacher in the sense of that anything was possible and that you really had to commit to a mission and you could succeed. And she took us all over the world playing violin. And she also taught us how to play every kind of music possible. She took us to Jordan in 1983, and we played in the ancient city of Jerash for King Hussein and Queen Noor, and, you know, we had some amazing experiences, but really she was just, and is, just such a dynamic influence in my life. So anyway.
Well, it sounds like you've had quite a few interesting influences along the way.
Yeah, well, you know, my parents are incredible. And
I'd like to ask you that. Why did your father go to Mexico? What was his purpose?
Well, he had been... he was at Harvard. He did undergraduate and graduate there, and then at Chicago. And he was working actually for. He's an interesting. I mean, my dad's an amazing guy. He was actually voted the number one college prankster of the 20th century by Rolling Stone magazine.
Wow.
For a prank he did when he was president of the Crimson. But
and what was that? Could you briefly
remember? He basically one night and his friends, who included David Halberstam and some other luminaries, decided to steal the ibis bird off the Lampoon building. And so one of them, they ran up, they stole this bird. And the next day, John Updike, who was head of the Lampoon in a fury, kidnapped my dad. So it was basically, you know, he said, it's the bird or McCobie. So they set up, after a couple of days, they set up an exchange, and as they were doing the exchange, David Halberstam ran out of the car, grabbed my dad, and they ran off with a bird, and they drove to New York with another of their friends. And their other friend was George Abrams, who went on to become Viacom's lawyer. He's Sumner Redstone's lawyer. Anyway, so they went to New York, and they had a press conference, and they announced that they were, in honor of Jack Reed, the only, you know, Harvard Lampoon president buried in the Crimson, they were going to, buried in the Kremlin, they were going to donate this bird to the new Moscow University. And this is in 1953, at the height of the Cold War.
Wow.
And so there's this picture of, you know, my dad giving the bird to the Soviet ambassador, and, you know, this picture of Stalin in the background. And that day, next day, the headline of the New York Times, all the papers, was Harvard gives Soviets the bird.
Yeah, pretty strange, huh?
So it went up, you know, anyway, it was a big deal. So he's studying psychoanalysis, and he was McGeorge Bundy's assistant at Harvard. And so Bundy, when Kennedy came into power, he asked my dad to join them in Washington. So my dad went there, but he kind of thought they were warmongers, and he had this other invitation by Fromm to investigate love and character and the evolution of the species of humans, and so he decided that that was what he wanted to devote his life to.
Very interesting. And so you came to be born there in Mexico City.
I came to be born there in Mexico City, yes. And and we spent summers in Cuernavaca, so I definitely was able to. My sisters are more, like, they went to school in Mexico. They're older than me. My younger brother and I were more American, but we definitely had that the culture there, and definitely that energy of Mexico, which is an incredible place. So then I became a filmmaker, and
among your filmmaking credits is Buffalo Soldiers?
Yeah. So yeah, that was a really wild experience. I was living in England, and my ex-boyfriend was a herbal medicine practitioner, so I was also living with a bunch of herbal medicine students, learning about the land and how to farm, and you know, what constituted health and food, and, you know, all these things, which became the building blocks for me of understanding energy on an individual level and on a community level.
And you're referring, of course, to alternative or clean energy.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm referring really to the whole concept of energy, and, you know, the fact that, you know, we're made of matter, and what is matter but vibrating molecules held together by sound, and what creates that? What is our life about? You know, I mean, it becomes very philosophical, but it's also very real. And so you think about, I was able to understand with just my physical health after living in Los Angeles for, and then being in the English countryside, I suddenly, you know, there's this, like, connection with the land. And I'd had certain, you know, sort of chronic ailments, nothing serious, but just chronic ailments. And I discovered when, you know, it was like, you are what you eat, you know, that it was incredible change in my ability to think and live when I started to understand that you are what you eat, and that there were other ways to exist, that we were sort of living in this false reality. And Buffalo Soldiers, of course, was a culmination of some work I had done earlier. In the late 80s, I had worked for Dispatch's current events show in London for Channel 4, and we had done a program on the nuclear black market, which at the time was in Khartoum in the Sudan in the Hilton Hotel. And where you had various different countries and rogue nations and private individuals bidding on high-grade plutonium and uranium. And I had worked on the show. I was the intern, so I'd seen, like, you know, 50 hours of videotape. And when we aired this program, a few hours later, everybody except for one informant we had talked to had been killed.
Really?
Yeah. So that was pretty crazy. And then, you know, they never aired it again, and CNN refused to air it. So I and then I went back to school. So, you know, that had always kind of been in the background of my, you know, God, that's really crazy. And then when I'd gotten this job to do Buffalo Soldiers, I was like, oh, yeah. So...
Now, let me ask you something before you move on.
Yeah.
Your husband is involved in the U.S. military's efforts to control the spread of nuclear weapons. That's
mm-hmm.
part of his main job title.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Had you met him at the time you made that documentary? Or?
Mm-mm.
And we, so
no, that was years ago.
He wasn't in that at that time probably, huh?
I mean, we were, you know, I was really young. I was a junior in college. And
yeah, and he wasn't into that job title anyway.
No, he must have been. He was like a senior.
So it's sort of interesting that...
Yeah, it is really interesting. I mean, it was always like, you know, I never actively went out to, you know, document the military or, you know, maybe I did. I don't know. I remember I made a bunch of movies in film school, actually, now that I think about it, about the military. I guess the concept of growing up in Washington, you know, my whole neighborhood was CIA and embassies, so it was always there, you know, this idea that this undercurrent of that we were – in the midst of a perpetual war, and that there was our civilization was running on this, and this was ruled by these people that profited off of war, and that.
Well, that's what Dwight Eisenhower is famously quoted as having
sure.
said as he was leaving office, right?
Yeah.
The military-industrial complex can easily get out of control, and the fact that he gave that warning is
mm-hmm.
quite bizarre, really.
Mm-hmm.
That a U.S. president would do that.
Well, it's funny because growing up as a kid, you know, you sort of have a lot of, you know, you're like, who do these people think they are? And so I, you know, the parents, because all my friends, you know, their parents were CIA and, you know, dastardly, you know, people. But they're also human, and they're right there in front of you in flesh and blood. And sort of the conspiracy aspect of it becomes kind of murky because you're like, well, I saw that guy, you know, and he's, you know, Jason's father. And, you know, so... I think I had this sense like, well, this is my town. These people have overrun it. And what else is there to do but try to affect change? You know, there's no other – what else are we going to do, watch TV? No. Like, I refuse to be a zombie. And, you know, I've been there, actually. I've done that. Like, I've had my bouts with TV addiction. But, you know, it just seemed like, well, I've had a lot of near-death experiences in my life. And every time they kind of re-cleanse me to the point because and I again remember like, well, I don't want to be ashamed when I die, you know, I don't want to think that like I didn't do everything possibly that I could, and given my placement in this life with access to so many important people in all such a huge range, actually, from from my family and people I know. I guess I'm a social networker, and plus doing movies, you know, you reach a huge audience.
Yeah, well, apparently you have capitalized on your possibilities for the good of the planet, and to the point that the New York Post called you the Enviro-babe, which, by the way, my wife was a little bit apprehensive of me even conducting an interview with an Enviro-babe.
Oh, anyone can be an Enviro-babe.
That's what I told her. I said, honey, you are my Enviro-babe.
That's right. That's right. We have an Enviro-baby now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. He's our first first product of the energy consensus.
How do you like that? So you've... So
what happened was I then... Buffalo Soldiers was a very intense experience because we discovered, like, all the sort of bad stuff the military was doing. Big surprise. And that peace was harder than war. That was the premise of the movie. What do you do when you're at peace? You know, well, you do a lot of war games. You bust up the countryside of Germany. I mean, they weren't very happy about it. And $1 billion worth of weapons would go missing a year, just in Germany, probably into the, you know, selling into Turkey, to the Mujahideen, and et cetera. So that was pretty intense. And going to all these army bases in Germany where, you know, we had just basically taken over Nazi bases. And when you go in these bases, you can see this whole history of just kind of darkness. And so I was pretty blown out by that. It was a very, very extreme experience for everybody involved, not always so pleasant. And around the time it ended, I moved to Grenada, to the West Indies, to investigate what happened to Maurice Bishop and why we invaded Grenada, and then simultaneously to assist in herbal medicine research and looking at cures, natural cures for children's diarrhea. And it was very, you know, I was so cold from being in Germany and England. It was really great to go down there, but also to just, you know, talk about switch into, you know, standard of living and life and, you know, such incredible beauty and richness of ecodiversity and everything. And unfortunately, we were all hit by dengue fever and also Buffalo. It was September 11th. We went down there in August 2001, and then September 11th happened, and that kind of just shifted everything. Buffalo Soldiers was then shelved, kind of it was sort of banned in the U.S. for a while.
Really?
Yeah, and then people couldn't handle it, and they thought it was unpatriotic. And meanwhile, it was, you know, becoming a really big movie in England and Germany.
Now, when you're saying it was banned, I mean...
Well, I was told by some people in the Pentagon that it would not be shown while the war was being mounted because it made the military look bad.
You mean in the theaters?
Yeah, in the theaters, yeah. We were scheduled to go to 15,000 theaters. And
they canceled that?
Yeah.
Well, I think there were other films that had to be either delayed in their release or totally just shelved because of the climate.
Sure, yeah. Well, the climate was pretty bad. And so I started investigating these herbal medicine remedies, and we discovered that there was a cure for children's diarrhea of guava, the guava tree, which is actually an ancient Ayurvedic cure as well.
Really? Because I've heard that using what would you call an electrolyte, just orally, oral
mm-hmm.
rehydration, it's called.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be a pretty effective. And
oh, I'm sure. I mean, because it's dehydration that's, you know.
Yeah, I guess
it's
using salt and sugar in water.
Well.
But you found an herbal or a fruit answer.
Yeah, the guava tree, and various uses made into teas. Supposedly would cure it in 3 days. So then when I got dengue, it's a very unpleasant experience. But and I was reading The Constant Gardener, which is pretty intense. But the behavior of the pharmaceutical companies testing on humans in Africa. And at the end of the book, he says, you know, it's actually worse than this. And I was like, whoa. And when I was well enough to walk, I went to hear a lecture at the research station given by Dr. Norman Brown of Oxford, who first coined the term hotspots and was looking at eco-extinction in the early 70s. And he said, you know, when I first started looking at it, it was a couple species a day becoming extinct, and now it's 70 to 80 a day. This was in 2002.
Isn't that crazy?
This is now February 2002. And he said, basically, the fate of the planet rests on the choices that we make right now, that we are the tipping point, that never has the human being been more powerful than right now because those choices and actions have such an incredible ripple effect.
Well, it sounds like this may have been the fire lit under the two sisters and Leonardo DiCaprio, because their message in their recent documentary is quite along that line, isn't it?
Well, I think it's the obvious thing, you know. It's we're one planet. We have nowhere else to go. We have to make this change now, and we are the change. We're born into this time to be that change. And I would say that if we don't act on it, it's a wasted life. So I that was when. And then he said, you know, if one mosquito can decimate an entire population of humans, think what one human can do. And that really hit me because I had this moment with that last mosquito that had gotten me to have dengue, and I was like, wow, that, you know, I really wanted to test it out and see, like, what I could do. And so that's when I committed myself to the planet and was like, I'm just going to serve and, you know, throw myself out there and see what I can do.
Well,
and
it would appear that there are a growing number of people who are, you know, realizing the need and looking for some niche that they can fill, and
mm-hmm.
obviously they don't have the same connections that you have, which, you know, everyone can do something within the framework of their own circumstances.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But, I don't think, yeah.
Now, let's talk about what you've done. So this was around 2002 that you really...
Yeah, so then I hooked up...
...to save the
yeah,
planet.
Yeah, and luckily I had this vehicle of the film, so I was able to kind of use that to... and then also, you know, as I came back, I would go back and forth from Grenada to L.A. and Washington and London, and I was just amazed at how paralyzed everybody in the U.S. was after 9/11, because it really wasn't like that in the West Indies. And I was also really shocked at the change that had come over me in terms of what I considered a high standard of living at this point, because living in Grenada in this incredible beauty with, you know, just very, you know, fresh fruit and fish and, you know, just incredible beauty every single day, and weather and, you know, the just this incredible eco-diversity.
Yeah, I've wanted to go there. I've done a lot of reading about it. And
well, the whole region, I mean, and that was why Dr. Norman Brown had been there. He was addressing all the governments of the West Indies saying, listen, you guys are the rich nations now because you have, you know, such a wealth of eco-diversity that this entire planet needs to survive because this web of intricate, connected agricultural system is its survival depends on this eco-diversity continuing. And when you look at invertebrate species alone, you know, there are like 3 in the UK, and then there's, you know, hundreds in the West Indies. So we were starting to understand the new values that were being assigned, and a new paradigm shift that was occurring in terms of energy and the environment and communication. And historically, when you look at really big change on this planet, energy advances in energy technology and communication technology occur at the same time, from the Sumerian cuneiform writing to agricultural innovations, the printing press and coal and the telegraph and oil, and then you have the internet, and I think that's where advanced energy technology comes in, and this whole idea that you're leveling the playing field. You have a distributed grid instead of this like crazy grid system that we have now, which is like it feels like Soviet Russia. You know, it's just like Big Brother. You know, we're dependent on we have no power, and so starting to understand systems was key for me. And so,
by the way, speaking of the grid. Mm-hmm. There have been some ice storms in the Midwest United States over the last 48 hours or so, and hundreds of thousands of people are without power.
Oh, my God.
It was bad enough yesterday, but today they announced that double the 600,000 who were without power yesterday are now without power.
Oh, my God.
And every time this happens, I think about how archaic this grid is.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's just so ridiculous that we should all be tied into one source of energy from a polluting, you know, smokestack.
It's completely illogical, and it's something that we all talk about a lot, which is this, I mean, behavior change. How do you change behavior? How do you change people from doing something, you know, how do you wake them up from doing something that's really bad for them? And again, it's this dependency. It's being lulled. It's this bad system of like being zombified and lulled into this idea that, you know, we're like sheeple, you know, we're just supposed to consume and consume, and that's our job is to consume, be consumers. You know, even the word, like, you're a consumer. I mean, it's so denigrating.
Well, the whole concept is really tantamount to the downfall of this environment, because you can't be a consumer. For instance, I've thought about the packaging industry.
Mm-hmm, sure.
How can the packaging industry, which is one of the huge industries in the world, because everything comes in a package,
mm-hmm.
how could they ever encourage you to not utilize packaging?
Right.
It would mean the end of their business.
Right, right. Well, this is, it's a product of linear thinking and very short linear thinking, which is going to end whether we like it or not. And so at this point, you know, it's bad, and we're talking about how many people are going to survive. So we need to move on it and wake as many people up as possible because, you know, I believe in life. And what's been amazing is meeting all these people in the military who feel the same way. And I think it's because they're on the front lines and they see what's happening and they know that they're going to have to be the people. They're serving. You know, they're very into, it's like the services. I've been just blown away by the people I've been meeting in the military. And it's so unlike.
It's a strange change, isn't it?
Yeah.
And perhaps we now could introduce your husband. Of course, he's not with us, as we had hoped, but perhaps you could just give his story or how you two met. Evidently, he's been a career military man.
Yeah, well, he's a nuclear engineer and, a scientist. So he understands advanced energy technology, and he's also a very spiritual person. So he's very tuned into the planet and people and humanity and life, and so he sees his role. I think he would have been a priest if he hadn't gone into the service. And so he on his own was investigating, how can we get off this dependency, because we're, using such an archaic, ridiculous fuel. And it is ironic also because my mother's great uncle invented the process of turning oil into gas. His name was William Walker, and he started the chemical engineering departments at MIT and Caltech, and he's probably the reason Standard Oil got so rich. So there's sort of a karmic weirdness there. And,
yeah.
So I kind of, that was another, I kind of felt like I had to redeem some of the family. So,
pardon me. That's pretty funny.
Yeah, and it's weird because Todd looks exactly like him, so. Anyway,
speaking of how you look, there's a picture on the internet of you two together.
Mm-hmm.
And when I see you two together and I read your story, what the two of you are doing, I couldn't help but think of a movie script, an action movie, wherein your two career paths come together in some disaster that is very exciting to watch on the screen. And then I started thinking of what actors would portray you two.
Okay.
And I asked my wife, I said, now who do you think? I said, I think George Clooney looks enough like your husband that he would play him. So I was asking her, who would play Nora, And so she came up, what did you say, honey? Barbara Hershey. I said, well, she's too old. Yeah, she said she's young looking.
Oh, sweet. Well, I was actually like 8 months pregnant in that picture, so kind of.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
We are together because of Donald Rumsfeld.
Okay.
We owe our destiny to Donald Rumsfeld because of my meeting with him and him sending out the memo and the snowflake and that sort of activated our whole energy.
Maybe
consensus.
You could acquaint our audience with what meeting you're referring to.
Oh, okay. Well, let's see. I returned around the time of the last election. I returned to Washington and I was like, I'm just going to do whatever I can to try to get a good president in there. And I kind of gave myself to the Democrats and. I got on the whole voting machine issue, and I was working with some guys at MIT and trying to address this issue and get it to the Democratic leadership, and they just weren't addressing it. I didn't understand why we were having the election if the machines didn't work.
So you're referring to corruption of the voting machines?
Yeah.
Of the Diebold or
the Diebold? Yes. And so then I was just disgusted with the leadership, but I was so moved by the people of the party. I went to the convention and everything. I met such incredible people, and I was like, wow, this country just blows me away. But why do we have this bad leadership? And then I met this Republican from Ohio, and she, named Rachel Pearson, and she agreed with me about social issues, and we were like, why diversity and choice? Why are we having these conversations? Why is the whole election about that, So I was like, let's rebrand those words and make them energy words because we need choice with energy and we need diversity. And everybody can win. This isn't a lose-lose situation. It's not a win-lose situation. It's a win-win. Everyone can profit and everyone can live. So let's do it, So I then met two vice presidents of very large energy companies who advised me to become very single-issued, and people couldn't handle the word environment and the rights, so I was like, well, let's talk about energy. So after that happened, we formed a nonprofit called Nature's Partners to do this bipartisan energy literacy initiative, and educate people on what happens when you plug into an outlet. Where does the energy go? How does it work? Because, you know, most people have no idea how they're consuming, what incorporates. And so to try to make connections in people's minds, just visually, subliminally, any way possible. So we started this.
The mission statement of Nature's Partners earlier today, and it really is an excellent mission statement.
And to partner with nature, partner with what we have. You know, there's so many solutions out there, and it's really exciting. It's what America is all about. It's this innovation. It's like starting new business. You don't have to leave out capitalism. It's very conducive to the situation.
You're talking about the pioneer spirit or the frontier type spirit.
Exactly, and especially two words, very key words, common sense. Common sense solutions. You know, using what you have. You know, taking the logical steps instead of the illogical steps. Living in reality rather than in a fantasy world, which I think is, you know, especially fostered and corrupted by the media, unfortunately, which is something I'm a part of.
The media wants people to be on a mental wavelength wherein they don't even consider conversations like the one we're having now.
No, what happens is that television becomes the standard of reality. And it's not reality because most of it's advertising. So you're living in a false reality. You think it's what is being shown to you, and it's not, because they don't tell you, you know, they tell you maybe 5% of the reality of what's going on. The reality is really where you are at. You know, and that's why the internet actually is a great thing, because it gives you so many choices about realities. And of course, you get into the concept of reality, and that, you know, can take you into quantum physics, which is very, you know, which is fine. But you know, and ultimately that brings you back to God and oneness, and we're all part of this one thing, which is right now planet Earth. The idea of separation and linear, you know, there's a beginning, middle, and end. It's not actually realistic. There's cycles and there's endlessness. When I started Nature's Partners, suddenly I got activated, and, you know, and then I met a woman named Mitzi Wertheim, who had started something called the Energy Consensus, which was a interdepartmental, mostly military services, people coming together to talk about energy and initiative, literacy, systems thinking, everything. And so we started this, it was like a 24-hour internet group, and we'd have meetings once a month, and I started becoming really educated in energy. And around this time, I then met a Qigong master woman from China who works at CDC named Yinong Chong, and she introduced me to a man named He Ping, who is the president of the International Fund for China's Environment. And he asked me to put together an energy delegation, clean energy technology, and go to China. And this I did, and I put together a great team.
And when was this?
This was in November 2005.
Okay.
And because we didn't really have any diplomacy going with the Chinese at that time that I could tell, they treated us incredibly. And, you know, we had three meetings a day, like with flags. And the first day I had to give a speech to 220 mayors in Shanghai, and it was like, you know, suddenly we could just say it out loud. You know, we are the future. We are the hope. And they were just right there with me. And, you know, it's incredible energy there because the 11th five-year plan had just come out and was a $182 billion investment into clean energy. And,
now, the common perception of China at this time is that there's a tremendous amount of filthy coal burning going on and so on.
And there is. There is. We could hardly breathe while we were there. But, you know, you're not going to change. How many people over there? A couple billion?
A billion, yeah.
You're not going to shift that overnight, although I trust the Chinese can do whatever they put their minds to because they're amazing, amazing people. And, you know, the top 10 leaders of the Central Committee are engineers, and they get it. You know, it's like, I think there is some disconnect on the provincial level, some corruption, but and then you've got the military in there. So, you know, in terms of fluidity of leadership, there, you know, that's an issue. But their survival is at stake, and our survival is at stake. And China and the U.S. are married. You know, we're like the opposites of each other. one new, one old, one very able to do anything, the other acting on its innovation. And you know, the pollution in California is coming from China, and we are one world. So they own us, we own them. You know, I don't want to go to war over oil, you know, and that's an end game, you know, play that, you know, both sides have. So we are looking to bridge the East-West divide and to unify our efforts and come up with advanced energy technologies to ensure the future of the planet. And we have to do that in partnership with China.
Now, is there advanced energy technology that's been in use in China for some time, at least in a limited way, that people in this country are generally not aware of, that you found?
We are in contact with some amazing groups over there who are very, very close to bringing those out, and are looking to do that in partnership with the U.S. And we also over here have some incredible inventors and scientists who are very close to bringing their technology to prototype. And so, you know, this isn't a situation where it's like one guy is going to save the whole planet or one technology. This is a false notion of this. You know, it's like only one thing, you know, like the one oil solution, only liquid fuels. And this is crazy. You look at the planet, and we run on diversity. Diversity is good. In every single field, in every single concept, diversity is good.
Well, it seems like if you do too much of any one thing, it ends up becoming some kind of pollution problem anyway, huh? Just for the sheer volume of it.
Yeah, yeah. We need lots of solutions, and we need to implement them all now. So we don't really have time to, you know.
Yeah, for instance,
argue about
I wouldn't
that.
Recommend converting water into hydrogen and oxygen, even though that's been the thrust of my work.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't recommend it as the ultimate energy solution because it will have an effect on the atmosphere of this planet.
Exactly. So, but it'll work well in certain areas.
Yeah, and so, I say, diversity in energy solutions is definitely preferable.
Right, and this is very good in terms of economics as well because you get to create many, many different markets. And that, you know, that's profitable for many, many more people. I think maybe those who only want themselves to be profiting are the people putting up the resistance.
Absolutely.
You know, we're finding this, like, I'm on strike right now as a screenwriter, and, you know, it's that too will be is a big paradigm shift because the majors don't want the writers to participate in any of this. And I've also really, like, working with inventors and advanced energy technology people, it's so similar to Hollywood in terms of, you know, the creators getting the bad stick of the deal. You know, the people
who
actually come up with the ideas getting shafted. And it's the writer and the inventor, same thing. But anyway, to get back to it, so I came back after just being blown away by China and just, like, you know, totally energized. And, of course, learning that China means energy. China is energy. So this...
Really?
Yeah, she is energy and na. You know, China, it's like vibrating at a faster rate than here. You come back to America, you're like, wow, it's so slow. So I came back and went to a party my sister threw for her mother-in-law, Betsy Folger, and Donald Rumsfeld was there, and I was like, okay, I just got to tell him what's going on. So I went up to him, and I started talking to him and telling him that, you know, we could redeem the Bush administration, we could be leaders of the world, we could, you know, work on what's great about America, innovation and new markets, and that new currencies were being created and the whole world was moving ahead without us using our technology, and the incredible stuff that was happening with the Chinese leadership and the services that were moving forward on solutions in our country, you know, that should be seen, and what were we doing about advanced energy technology. So he ended up, like, writing down what I was saying, and he was a fantastic listener. I was shocked. I it was the last thing I would have thought, but the guy was, I had an amazing experience with him. I really liked him.
Interesting.
Yeah, but you know, it also fell into the good side of him, which was trying to modernize the positive aspects of his attempt to modernize and transform the military. So then he sent out a memo the next day based on this conversation, what are we doing on energy? And the QDR reports were coming out, and none of them mentioned energy. So suddenly people were tapping into our group, the Energy Consensus, saying, hey, you guys know anything about energy? And then Mitzi was like, what's going on? And I said, oh, I saw the secretary. And she's like, oh, my God. So we started writing it. We created this email discussion. If you had 15 minutes with the secretary, what would you say? And came up with all these amazing ideas, and that suddenly, you know, we became a source at DOD, and then this grew. Rumsfeld, I guess, put some attention and money towards it, and it became this something called the Energy Conversation, which now incorporates all the State Department, Congress, Transportation, Agriculture, every single department.
So it snowballed.
It snowballed, and it became a snowstorm, and then when the president's speech happened and the page six said, you know, Rami's got a new energy guru, and it was about me and him, that was like, I mean, the president's speech basically made it okay for people to talk about clean energy and to talk about new solutions and to acknowledge what many of us knew, which was that, you know, we were fighting a bad war in Iraq for oil, one of the reasons we're there, and, you know, that some people were driving... some people were losing their lives so that other people could drive Hummers. You know, it's kind of where we're at. And
now, are you referring to Mr. Bush's reference to, in his State of the Union address a year ago, I think it was, when he said Americans will be startled by what's coming down the pike in the way of energy alternatives?
No, I mean, there's been a... that's something else, yeah.
Or was it 2 years ago when he...
Addicted to oil was the break. It was like the floodgates opened. It was okay. Suddenly, you know, it was okay to... People were buying the technology, new technology, like Amory Lovins and Scott Sklar. People were listening to them. It was suddenly... The gates were opened. And things started to move much, much faster. And... it was through this group that became that I met my husband, that I met Todd. It was.
Oh, is that right?
Okay. Yeah. So he then started going to the energy meetings because of the Rumsfeld memo, and then he had been working. I got a husband and a baby out of it. Cutest baby on the planet, and best husband in the world, and.
Well,
yeah, he came. He's
a funny pairing of you two because your husband. Is an Army major, and he's involved in trying to control the spread of nuclear weapons. That's his primary job title, isn't it? But he's also using his background in engineering to promote the clean energy technologies. In fact, you had a meeting, this was August 20th of this year?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Would you explain what the Potomac Energy Project consists of?
It's an initiative to create sustainable communities. Right now it's about supporting advanced energy technologies and bringing them to the public.
And is this headed by you two, or who's actually responsible for the Potomac Energy Project?
Well, I guess we are. I mean, Todd many years ago started going, you know, contacting inventors and advanced science researchers because he understands the technology aspect of it, and supporting them, you know, getting them money and supporting them emotionally, and you know, he's like a producer.
Yeah, I think he's actually mentioned that he has divested himself of around $200,000 in trying to alternative energy device development.
Yeah, he's taken out student loans and. I mean, you know, this isn't like any, there's no surplus money here. He's actually just taken it upon himself to find, you know, to get the student loans and get it to people because he believes that the future of our planet depends on it.
Okay, so on August 20th in Bethesda, Maryland, you had a meeting. Was it in your home or?
Yeah, it was in our home.
Okay.
And we brought people from all over the world, all over the country, most brilliant minds and brought them together, which was really fun and great because they hadn't all come together like
that. For those who weren't in attendance, you can go online and actually listen to or watch on video on your computer screen some of the presentations that were made at that meeting. Quite a historic meeting. Of course, there are alternative energy conferences held all over the place now, but this was a good example of the kind of focus that can and should be brought on these inventors and people who are knowledgeable about the different concepts and how they can be developed and applied.
Yeah. I mean, Todd really, you know, being an Army officer, one of his main intents was, you know, to stop the killing and the death of his fellow soldiers and the people on the fields.
Over
civilians and over oil, over energy, when he knew and we knew that there were other solutions.
And another thing, I think that part of the message that he and others have tried to convey is that national security really is largely linked to energy.
Oh, of course.
And not just
yeah.
because of the war for oil thing, but because national security includes having access to what modern society needs at this time, which is a way to power your life.
Exactly. It's like it's like any addiction, you know. I mean, the president was right on that line. You know, we are addicts. We're zombies right now. You know, if you were looking at just your personal health, if you had to, you know, I mean, it's a bit actually like that on the health issue, too. I mean, a lot of people are addicted to things.
Yeah.
And as a society, we're addicted to this thing, and
well,
we're not independent.
Even addicted to junk food, for that matter. Even if it's not a medication,
yeah.
just the fact that we're eating poisonous food that is not good for us, we know it, but we're sort of addicted to it.
That's right. And how do you change behavior? That's a big part of it. You need leadership, and you need initiative. And I've found that in my life, like, you know, we all have addictions. We all have that sort of, you know, you get tired. You don't want to do it anymore. And I have found making that little bit of extra effort that actually doesn't require that much, just that little extra. It's like these pivotal moments I've had in my life where I was like, I'm not going to hate. I'm gonna actually reach my hand out and take that other person's hand. I'm gonna be energy efficient about my emotions and my choices. And the path of least resistance, I guess, is actually the path of love and peace and joy rather than division and hate and anti-ness. You know, anything that's anti, it's not gonna work.
Well, and I admire that about the tenor of your comments. It isn't like you're out trying to badmouth and attack the establishment for not having done things sooner and having been corrupted by the lobbies of these powerful, you know, suppliers of these.
There's no time for that. You know, we don't have time to lament. We don't have time to complain. We don't have time to judge and point fingers.
So instead, highlight and showcase the positive things that can be done, things that are doable, and by publicizing them and changing the consciousness of society with regard to these possibilities, then it's bound to get implemented.
Well, also because as, you know, the communication paradigm shift and the energy paradigm shift happens, so does consciousness paradigm shift have to happen at the same time. There's a reason that we're still, you know, in the mucky muck of the planet's blood, which is oil. You know, it's we're in there because we're still primitive. We're still savage. We haven't risen above our primal sort of greedy impulse. We're like children, and we need to grow up. And that's not so hard to do. It's actually fun.
But it's
and
not
I think,
something that you can force people to do.
No, you have to be inspired. You know, and I think there's opportunity there because it's life. It's like, hey guys, you know, you can live in this really big, you know, disaster hole, or you can, you know, there's amazing life out there, and adventure, and possibility, and possible things are possible.
Yeah, well,
you know.
I agree with you that the basic problem is a spiritual one.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with people's, you know, like you say, love is a basic quality that is lacking. And,
yeah.
I think that's manifest in a lot of the debate that's going on, for instance, in this country right now. There's a tremendous change in the way people are talking about other people.
I think that's something that, I mean, I'm very much inspired by Obama, and I believe that, you know, I think people talking about his inexperience are, I think that's wrong. I don't think that's a, you look at Lincoln, that wasn't, he's very similar to Lincoln, actually. I think he has what it takes to take us to that point. I don't think there's any other candidate there who has that kind of spiritual quality.
Well, my candidate is not among any of them. But and I'm looking upward, you know, and I'm praying for a kingdom to come, and I'm hoping that that's, and I know that that's the ultimate solution. Until that time, I don't think human politics is going to do anything different than what it has done.
No, but I think little shifts are make a big difference. You know, people used to say, oh, it doesn't matter who's, you know, the left or the right. Well, I think actually it does, actually, a little bit. And
well,
those little bits are...
Well, you've manifested that no matter who's in power, a person like yourself and like your husband can get in there and try to affect some change for the good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So whether it be this or that party or this or that candidate, if there are people like you and your husband active in promoting clean energy technology, then intelligent people will pay attention and listen and try to at least in some minimal way show that they are in favor of what is the most intelligent thing to be doing.
I think people should remember that we're all on intergalactic television. And the whole universe is looking at us right now and seeing what we're going to do. And I think every individual is famous. And every individual is a hero in the making. And they need to step into the light. And that step is not so hard to do. And when they start doing it just on an individual level, like, you know, smiling at the person on the street or, you know, giving somebody a hand up, on every level that they're going to implement the choice of love rather than hate or divisiveness or, you know, whatever
you
that negative.
If there is a scorecard being marked, if you want to put it that way, you feel like we are being observed for to see what kind of reaction or behavior
big time.
Carrying out. Yeah, well, that's I think something that all the major religions of the world throughout history have taught that there is you know, a balance sheet, if you want to call it that, or whatever. That,
well, it's Judgment Day, and it's here and it's now. You know, it's not in the future, it's not in the past, it's not in some other reality. It's in this reality, and it's happening right now.
Okay, so your mission statement is that energy is something that everyone should be concerned about because it affects this planet. If all of us use it, all of us should be aware of the...
We wouldn't be here without energy. It's energy that keeps us alive. Everything is energy. There's not anything that is not energy.
But in particular, our use of energy in our daily lives, something that your Nature's Partners mission statement, it does a good job emphasizing, and trying to get to children, too.
Well, yeah.
Part of your effort is helping young people to appreciate that turning on a light switch or whatever has consequences.
Well, and that they matter. You know, I think a lot of people believe that they don't matter because the system has been set up for them to just, oh, they're just a consumer over there. But they're not. They're you know, part of God. Everyone's part of God. So if there's a part of God in you, that means that, you know, the miraculous is within you. And it's all about how you choose to approach your reality.
Yeah, well, one thing I've tried to encourage through this program is teaching children to be more inventive and, I mean, giving them the opportunities as they grow up to be more like our ancestors in this country, who were people who pretty much had to work out their own problems, you know? They didn't look to big business to sell in Walmart some answer to their problems.
Right.
They actually went out to their shop and, you know, they fixed their own windmill if it broke.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think that's what we've failed to do as we've gotten more dependent on technology is to do that ourselves. I mean, now I notice, like, for instance, nobody ever raises their hood anymore. When you go to a gas station, how many times do you see people raise their hood?
Mm.
It hasn't happened anymore because technology has made us actually, cars are more reliable than they used to be. They don't have to be checked so often, right? You can drive a car for thousands of miles without even looking under the hood.
Right.
Unlike the old days. But also, if a person did raise their hood, they wouldn't understand what was there anymore anyway, because it's so covered with technological junk, you know? Which
right.
is good in a way, but it keeps you from being proactive in, for instance, coming up with an alternate fuel system for your vehicle.
Well, I think just the idea of, well, there's so much that's going to change. I mean, everything's going to change.
And so what did you, for instance, view as being the most promising thing that you saw at your...
I'm a big fan of Eddie Sines and the Sines Reluctance Generator. That's actually what brought me and Todd together, was that presentation. He has basically a energy device that works on magnets, superconductivity. You can go look at it on the New Energy Congress website. To me, it embodies this whole paradigm shift. It's utilizing the Casimir effect.
And this is to generate electricity.
Yeah, it generates electricity. It's basically the smallest prototype is as big as your hand. And
is something that could take people off the grid, in other words.
Take them off the grid. They can power their cars with it and power their house. You need liquid nitrogen to keep it cool, but that's it. And you're good to go for a couple hundred years. And, imagine the effect that's going to have.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, how would, for instance, the Chinese react to this kind of technology?
They have similar technologies that one that's about to pass through the 6-month peer review that they're going to be coming out with. And, we're on the cusp of a revolution. We're on the cusp of an innovation revolution. This whole planet's going to just, it's very exciting. That's the upside. If we can, we have this opening right now. It's like we need to partner. We need to make these things, like, help them come to market and distribute them all over the planet and ensure survivability. Because even with these technology, we're still going to be dealing with the effects of our past behavior on this planet and the changes that come about that, which are pretty substantial. But we have an opening right now to ensure more survivability and independence and enable this spiritual growing up of the human species.
Well, we would hope that these technologies, such as Mr. Sines and others, will be embraced by the world at large in a big way and in the not.
Yeah, and because the thing is, it's going to stop using oil. We're going to stop using wind or solar or whatever. We're not. Those things are going to keep happening. Our entire civilization is running on petroleum, from pharmaceuticals to agricultural fertilizer to plastics. We need the oil, but we don't need it to power our houses and our cars. So, it's, again, diversity. Let's use it where we need it most desperately and then find other solutions.
By introducing other things, you're reducing the consumption of that.
Exactly. And you're saving lives. And you see that, on the ground in Iraq. There's a guy named General Zilmer who started utilizing solar and wind units, sky-built units, to save lives, because people get blown up when they're transporting fuels. And you see, the military is always at the forefront of bringing new technology to the world. And, solar nanotechnology, you have backpacks that, make soldier totally energy independent, solar fabric and solar, you can make solar with nano, you can do it on anything. So you have solar paint and solar everything. It's very exciting.
Yeah, it is quite exciting. And I look forward to hearing more from you in the future about new developments and, bringing to fruition some of the things you've already highlighted at your energy conference. Well, it's been nice having you as a guest.
Thank you.
Look forward to talking with you again, talking with your husband, too, at some future time.
Lovely, and thank you very much for having us.
And take care of that Enviro baby.
I will.
take care and thank you.
Okay, bye.